family. My name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm Jewish, not Irish. Right. I'm on airplane mode here, but I don't want to go over. Put this back in my pocket. Thank you, Pat, for asking me to speak. I know tonight that I'm going to talk about being able to live sober through Alcoholics Anonymous and the rich joy that's in my life as a result of that. But I don't know exactly what stories are going to come out to demonstrate that point, so I'm going to try to stay out of that. And this year I've been having a really hard time speaking in AA because I can't seem to separate the fear, you know, of not being connected with you guys and my experience not matching yours and not being good enough and what you all think about me. And it just cuts it. I just get up here and it really, it's like no matter what I do, like I could pray and meditate. I could not pray and meditate. I could call someone. I could not call someone. I can do all the list of management and I come up here and this is just the experience that I've been having in AA for the last year. So I just get up here and I just don't know what to say anymore. And I think that it's revealing to me that I worship having a certain reputation here. That's something other than just shoulder-to-shoulder AA member. Because that's all I am. I'm a drunk who got to stay sober today because of my connection to a power greater than myself. And that's who I'm going to be after this is over. And I'm just going to be hanging out with you guys, dancing and eating ZD. And doing whatever we do, you know, on Saturday night because we get to live today. But the rest of it really is nonsense. And funny, all those flyers were circulating, and a sponsor of mine, I was like, oh my God, my name's on the flyer, like everyone's seeing this, it's going all around, like everyone I knew was like, I can't wait to hear you, and and she was like, well, they're promoting the party, they're not promoting you, but like honestly, that had never occurred to me. So at some point in this talk, something that I did feel moved to do, you know, earlier in the week when I was thinking about doing this, the 12 steps have reminded me that I'm an extremely sensitive person and that I care a lot about everybody, you know, and I really have a lot of love in my heart and a lot of appreciation. And I was really cut off from that part of myself. I always knew that it was there, you know, growing up, but through the emotional alcoholism that developed before I started drinking and then during my active drinking, like I just could never access, I could never really tap into that true part of me that found its connection very naturally with the rest of you guys. So, you know, I think a lot of that is ego, but I felt, you know, really alone. And I've remembered that I'm that person. And one of the ways that shows up is that I appreciate sort of naturally things that maybe other people think I'm weird for appreciating. So sometimes, like on Friday nights when I'm leaving my office before I leave, it's like feels very natural for me to like turn back to my office and say, thank you for the week, office. Thanks for giving me a space to get my work done, you know. Thanks for giving me an environment to like come here, you know, and to be alone. You guys could just start dropping like flies if you want, because I'm just gonna go on like this. And I don't know, just like really taking a moment to like appreciate everything that I have and know that it's not mine, you know, but that space is available for me to get work done every day and that's a gift that I can be grateful for. And when my home group is Big Book Magic, we meet on Thursday nights at 7:45 at the Holy Apostles Church on 28th Street and 9th Avenue. I think I got it right. We just moved locations. Something that was so amazing right before we moved is we had like a big prayer in our last business meeting at the old space. And we took a moment to just reflect on like what that actual physical space had been a vessel and a vehicle for in all of our lives for the last 4 years or 3 years that we've been meeting there. So I think, I don't know, it might just be nice to, like, think about that with Pathway to Power, too. You know, like, how many sponsorship relationships, how many best friendships, how many, you know, amends were possible because of this meeting in this space, and, like, how many awesome things just organically happen as a result of us all coming here, just showing up every Wednesday and Saturday. I mean, not me. I'm only here for the parties. But my own was a big one. But for everyone else, you know? And just to really, like, feel the gravity of that, because that's God, you know? And we have to show up to be available for that, but, like, that's God. And it's all happening naturally. Right underneath all the other crap, all the business meeting drama, all the ego, all the fear. It's right there. It's been right there the whole time. So I trust that there's been many beautiful life-changing moments for a lot of people in this room as a result of Pathway to Power. And I think it's awesome just to take a moment to appreciate that and to be grateful for that in all of our lives. So my dad's here tonight. My dad's been sober. Is it 21? Where are you? I can't see. Dad, oh, you're right here. I think, like, the real miracle of my story is the fact that my dad stayed sober through all of the things that I'm about to tell you. I had my first drink. I don't even remember. I did not get drunk the first time that I had a drink. I would have very much liked to, but there wasn't enough. I think I was 12 or 13. And by the time I got sober, I was 15 years old, So it's sometimes hard for me to speak and to share my story with confidence about my alcoholism when I'm talking to people who really have like a 30, 40-year progression here. But luckily, the sponsors that I've had have pointed out what alcoholism is in the big book in terms of my relationship to alcohol. So I've been able to find that evidence of my alcoholism and ID myself and stay here, and I have a message. And many people can relate to my feelings, but it was reminded to me recently that I might be here just to talk to, like, the 17-year-old girl who's, like, not totally sure, like, what's going on. You know, I might not be here to talk to everybody, and I don't need to be. But, I don't know, we all have enough of the same common feelings and everything, so I'm sure that many parts of my story will translate, even if you're not a teenager. So I had my first drink when I was either 12 or 13, and I got drunk for the first time when I was 14. And I spent that whole, like, period of time in between, like, trying again, because I knew that it wasn't working yet, and I needed to make it work. And by the time I was 15, I had caused so much pain for myself and for my family, and I was in so much physical trouble. And I think my parents were fearing for my, not, you know, for my life, and even for their own physical well-being because of the people that I had, like, hooked myself in with. And I got sent to a long-term treatment center. And I got to experience untreated alcoholism at this treatment center. And that's what really drove me to my knees and cracked me open enough to actually want to start taking the spiritual suggestions seriously. Just to backtrack. Where do we start? I was ready for my first drink before I had it. Hey, Lindsay. I don't have my glasses on, so I really can't see that much. I think it's really important. Well, I don't know what's important, but I understand my alcoholism as primarily being a spiritual disease. And it has a mental and a physical manifestation that drive me to the substance of alcohol, but primarily it's an emotional disorder. And it started, if I look back in my history, it started sort of occurring for me when I was 6 years old. I really don't know if I was born an alcoholic or what, but I know just based on stories, when I was a toddler, I had a certain, like, freedom in the world. Like, I hear stories about myself as a kid, like, 2, 3 years old, and I, like, don't recognize that girl. Like, my mom would tell me that, oh my God, this is the most beautiful thing ever. This was a really tough year. We got bed bugs, all right? I know some of you have been there. It's the worst. And we got bed bugs, and I also live in an apartment that has 4 generations of stuff in it. So it took, like, 2 weeks working with professionals to clean out enough stuff to actually start the treatment. And I was sharing a bed with my mom for, like, 4 months or 5 months. I mean, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. We actually got closer during that time. Like, that was a real vessel for us to work out, like emotional stuff in our relationship that, like, had not yet been addressed. Like, and many times, you know, I I spent many years being like super pain avoidant. Like, I don't want to go through a hard time, or if I'm emotionally disturbed in any way, I think that means that I'm not working my program. Or that maybe I'm like not trusting God enough, or whatever I think you're going to think about me as a result of the emotional pain that I feel. And the truth is, like, that is like, I think a friend of mine has said this, that's like those times are fertile ground. You know, it's like, that's when we have the opportunity to seek. Like, that's when I turn back inward and I start doing more spiritual growth and I lean harder on the steps and I turn to AA and I maybe, you know, whatever. Like, that's when I grow, is like when I'm going through stuff. So to think that I should not go through hard stuff is just, it robs me of the opportunity to like really live those experiences in a way that's meaningful. But anyway, I don't really remember why I started talking about that. This was a tough year. The little girl. So my mom, during this whole thing, we're cleaning up. I'm putting eyeballs on like every single thing that I own, that my mom owns, that her mom owned, that her mom's mom owned. And my mom digs up this letter that she wrote to me after my second birthday. We had been in Martha's Vineyard together. And my mom, thank God she did this. If you have children, please do this for your children. This is like the most beautiful thing that I could have received as a 26-year-old, reading this letter that my mom wrote to me the week after my second birthday, telling me all about how much I loved Martha's Vineyard and how she was teaching me how to swim and how I was using all my like little, I mean, I still sort of proportionately, I still feel like I look like a toddler. Like, if you just like brought the scale up like to like 15 times on a toddler, I kind of feel like a big one. So she's talking about like my tiny little strong arms and how I was using like my best football moves to like evade her on the beach because I wanted to get into the ocean, you know? And like just, and I just like have this image of me as this like brave little girl with all this courage, and just, I just wanted to live. And I wanted to be free, and I wanted to experience the world. And, like, that's not me. Like, I hate the ocean. I will go to the beach, and I'll suffer through trying to get a tan, but, like, I do not like the water. It feels very unnatural to me. So to, like, hear about myself as this kid who loved these things, and then to see sort of, like, it just made me realize, like, how much, yes, like, the emotional trauma of life that we experience, but also alcoholism, and how much that, like, what a disconnection alcoholism is from, like, my spirit, you know? And a lot of, like, the work that I've done in AA has not been about managing whether or not I'm going to drink. It's been about, like, turning my attention back to that spirit and traveling deep within, back to that essence of who I am, because that's, like, really where I find God, and that's where I find the power that will protect me from the insanity of the first drink. And I have had times, like, when the bed bugs bit, if you will, like, there was one night I hadn't slept, and it, like, dawned on me that my brother had had beer in the fridge for, like, years. And, like, for a moment, I was, like, really afraid that I remembered that. Like, I almost, and this was, like, a year ago, I almost went to my mom's room and asked her to pour it out. Like, I was really conscious of the fact that there was beer in my fridge in a way that was really uncomfortable. And I just turned to prayer. I said, God, thank you so much for keeping me sober through this, and thank you for showing me what I need to see, you know? And I got through the night, and I didn't drink. And that's really, like, that's, like, the message that I've been given here, is that it's not necessarily in the long term about managing conditions so that I don't take a drink. It's about turning in and having a spiritual experience that feels true for me, that will intervene in those moments when otherwise I would have no choice but to drink. So, so that, like, stuff is, like, what I call the spiritual malady, and that started to happen to me when I was 6 years old. Is my stuff part of that? We should just start ripping things off the wall. I think the decorations are, like, ready for the party to start. Yeah, and so, like, this is also significant for me because, like, I've just turned 11 years sober, and, like, I have to, like, continue. I need to be here. I need to be here with you guys, and I need to keep doing this work, and I need to keep growing, and I need to keep expanding in my connection to my higher, in my awareness of my connection to my higher power. So this, like, it prickly is emotional stuff started for me when I was like 6 years old. I remember at that point consciously starting to compare myself to the other kids and feeling like my clothing wasn't right, or feeling like whatever girls were getting crushed on, I wasn't one of them. And we would have these horrible things called lunch dates in first grade. And I remember this kid named Eggie, and I made a lunch date with him, and he didn't come. And it was the worst. And, like, so stuff like that, you know? And, oh, thanks. My dad gave me half-drink water. I love you. And I don't know. I mean, like, that just, like, that consciousness that there was something wrong with me and I wasn't quite right, like, just, like, continued to get worse and worse and worse until my solutions to that problem got, like, really destructive. And so when I was 11 years old, it dawned on me that, like, there was a certain type of kid in my school that seemed to be cooler than the rest. And so I started trying to emulate that first, you know, that, like, personality or that reputation, and those were, like, the kids that were tough. So I started trying to act tough, and I thought that if I could get in with those kids that I would achieve some level of self-satisfaction and respect that would solve the problem that I felt that I had, which was me. I wasn't okay. I didn't feel okay. I really just feel like a huge part of my alcoholism was and continues to be delusional thinking. You know, and I had a lot of delusional thinking before I ever took a drink. Case in point, when I was when I was 12, I decided that there was a young man in the neighborhood that I wanted to get to know a little better. And so I proceeded to try to get closer to him. And one of the vessels for getting closer to him was his older brother. His older brother was 18. And while I may or may not have had some sort of experience with the younger brother, I got into a relationship with this 18-year-old when I was 12. And he also happened to sell crack cocaine in my neighborhood on the corner. And, like, this is insane, you know? But I really was possessed with the belief that, like, I needed to be in this relationship. I needed to be the kind of person that would be in the relationship. I needed to be loved by him. And I needed this whole lifestyle in order to have that shift that I was craving, you know, which eventually I found in alcohol. But I just didn't know that. So my decisions to, like, feel differently about myself continued to get worse and worse and worse and more destructive. And the first time I ever got asked to leave my mom's house, I was 12 years old because I'm big boned, if you will. I'm a big boned toddler in scale. And like, I really felt like I was going to die if I didn't, like, get things the way that I thought I needed them. And so I became, like, physically aggressive with my family. Like, don't come between me and a drink. But at that point, before I had the drink, don't come between me and that other stuff. And the fact that I love my family dearly and I get to have such a full relationship with all of them today, it just has no power over that. So my mom asked me to leave her house for the first time when I was 12. And down with the steps, up the steps. No, the tradition. Wow. I thought she was going again. She was going out for a second. I don't know. There was just, like, so much pain, and I was really uncontrollable, like, no human power. And I think had my parents really known what to do with me sooner, they would have. But eventually in this relationship, I really wanted to find out about alcohol. And he would come over, and he would have been drinking or doing whatever he was doing. And I was always very curious about alcohol. I mean, as long as I can remember, I was, like, interested in it. I knew that my dad got sober when I was 6 years old. And so I would always ask him about his experience with alcohol and, like, drugs. And, like, I was just very curious about, like, what the whole thing was. And I wanted to know more. And from a young age, I remember being like at family dinners and I would like take the bottle of wine and I would put it under my seat just to like have it close to me and just to have other people see that I had purposely taken the alcohol and put it under my seat. I don't really know what the significance of that is, but I like wanted to sort of be connected to it. And I had my first drink in this relationship and nothing really happened. And I think, my behavior continued to be like totally insane, but I don't even remember really. I think the next time that I drank was when I finally was able to get out of that relationship. I mean, like it's very similar for people who have been drinking for a long time. I think like I would make the decision to get out of the relationship and then we would break up and then it would be like 10 minutes later and we would be back together and I didn't want to be. I really wanted to like be a kid and I didn't want to be in this crazy insane relationship and I had no ability to get out of it. And one day, for whatever reason, and there's like a lot of really other crazy things that happened in this relationship, and I'll spare you guys like the intimate details. But it really is miraculous. Like I think my dad has like 6 or 7 years at this point, and his 12-year-old daughter is being the most insane. And he would go to the Breakfast Club meeting every morning. And like, I don't know, I imagine he would be like crying and sharing and like turning to his group and like really not knowing if I was going to die and really not knowing if I was going to like have a kid and really not knowing what was going to happen, but like trying to keep his faith in the program and trying to keep his faith that like when I was ready that I would like know where to go. So I'm so glad he had that. For whatever reason, we broke up this one last time. And when I was rounding the corner to go find him again, I ran into someone else. And that person offered me to come have some fun with some products, whatever. I got sober so young that I didn't really have the opportunity to do drugs other than alcohol. I mean, I smoked pot. My experience of pot was the first time I got high, I was like afraid that I was gonna get stuck that way. And I like wanted to take it back. I'll do anything. I was like doing such pot over. I like couldn't feel my face properly. I was scared. The first time I got drunk, I dropped out of high school. Like I was like, there's no need ever for anything other than this. It's okay if that's not your experience, but that's what happened to me. But anyway, I ran into this kid and he offered me a new freedom. And from there, like I just sort of took off. I started hanging out with this new group and I started doing new things and different things every day. And I really felt like I was like achieving that reputation of like the party girl and that was becoming a priority in my life. I mean, at this point, I still really had not gotten drunk. I don't know if I had a high tolerance or what, but like the obsession was on. And I think like that phenomenon of craving, that thing that happens to us when we take a drink. And for me, it's like, I just want, for me, the phenomenon of craving looked like I would go out to get drunk because I was 15 years old and I wanted to get drunk. So I would go get drunk, but then after already being drunk, I never hit a point where I felt like I'm good, I'm drunk enough. I would always be like panicking that like it was gonna wear off and then I needed to drink more and like make sure like where's the bottle, let's drink more. And I would always like I wouldn't be able to walk and I'd have to be carried home. I mean, it was like I was never actually having the fun time that I wanted to have. And in the beginning, it dawned on me that like the way my phenomenon of craving worked back then before I was actually getting drunk was that I would go to drink and I'd be so excited at the prospect of this like incredible party night we were gonna have and all the freedom that I would feel. And then I would like start drinking and we would run out, or it was like Alizé and like that really didn't do anything, or whatever it was. And then I would be on my way home on the subway, because I grew up in Manhattan, so I'd be like on the subway coming from Washington Heights and I would be like so upset. Because like I just was had that restless, irritable, discontent feeling because I had started drinking and there wasn't enough, and then I just had to stop abruptly and go home. It's the worst. And so that's kind of like what it looked like for me, you know. And like I didn't really understand like the strange mental blank spot, the mental twist. I mean, I had sponsors taking me through the Big Book and stuff, but I just didn't. I never really was presented with that idea in a way that I like sunk down on. So, but the mental insanity, you know, surrounding the first drink is that basically I cannot continuously prevent myself from taking the first drink just because I want to stay sober, or just because I try to remember the consequences of my last drink, or remember the consequences, the projected consequences of what might happen, that I don't have the ability to be consistently sane around taking a drink. I just don't have that luxury. And so I never, as a 15-year-old, you know, coming into AA, I didn't like try to quit a bunch of times and like watch myself fail over and over again. But every single time that I went out to drink, it was at the expense of something otherwise that would have been really important to me. Like, in my heart, like, these things are really important to me, like my connection to you and my family, and like, you know, being like the best version of myself and loving myself. Like, these things are like really high on the list. And every single time I went to drink, it was at the expense of all of that. And I had no ability to like reason, you know. It really was like, It was the best idea and the worst idea at the very same time, every time I went to drink. So, I don't know, fast forward, I'm in 10th grade. I've pretty much dropped out of high school. I did eventually get drunk for the first time, and it was miraculous. And I don't know, like, instantly, like, that priority shift happened. I mean, I found myself like as a 15-year-old, and really like the number one thing that I had like passion for was like the idea that I might be able to get drunk that day. Like, that was like the only thing that made me feel physically excited about life. Relationship stuff like that had stopped working for me. That was no longer making me feel better. And any other thing really wasn't either. But I really found myself in this position where I was living to drink, and I was in a position where I thought I was pregnant again at 15, and I was in a special school because my therapist thought I had ADD, which I might have, I don't know, but I definitely had alcoholism. I don't know, like, my life is just really dark, and I've like severed my relationship with my brother and my mom and my dad, and I went out over Christmas break, and I just did what we do, you know. And I had been sick. I had had a cold at the beginning of that week. And then because I neglected to take care of myself, and I just went out partying the whole time. Partying for me means drinking a 40 in a stairwell of one of the buildings in the Amsterdam houses. That's what partying for me looks like, or in somebody's like seedy apartment. Like, that's what partying is. just to clarify. Yeah. And I woke up the next Monday when it was time to go back to school, and I had bronchitis. Many of you who have heard my story know this part of my story, but I just, it became very clear to me that, like, my brother had already left for school. And he was, like, at school living his life, and, like, he was in, like, chemistry class or whatever he was doing. And my mom works from home, and her work day had begun. She's a writer. So I heard, like, you know, click, clack. I heard, like, all the typing in her bedroom. And I had this feeling that, like, everyone else's lives had started for the day. And I was stuck in this pain of waking up after a week-long run of hating myself for all the things that I had done, and this isn't going to be a poem, and just feeling trapped, you know, in this experience of life, in this alcoholic experience of life. And there was something deep in my being that knew that I wasn't going to be able to just, like, grow out of this fate, you know, that, like, that feeling of, like, watching life happen, like, from behind a glass wall or from underneath a glass floor was, like, going to continue to get worse and worse. And I was just desperate. Like, I think, like, again, like, I really just believe so strongly that, like, the essence of who we all come into the world as is, like, perfect and beautiful. And I think that I had, like, a taste of that connection to my higher power, like, when I was very small. And, like, somewhere, it never left. It was always there. I just completely fell asleep to it, and I was, like, craving that experience. And I think it's Jung that says that, you know, alcoholism is, like, a low-level search for God. And yeah, I just, like, had, like, that whatever was, like, still
still attached to my spirit, or whatever part of my spirit was still attached to me at that point, was sort of like trying to get my attention this morning. And I went to my mom's room and I conveyed, you know, the mess. I mean, it wasn't like happening in secret, like she knew what was going on. But I went in there and I said, you know, this is what's going on. And I want to try to get sober. I don't even remember what I said, but I know I meant it. I knew I was scared, and I knew that I was desperate. And she basically revealed to me that she and my dad had been looking at long-term treatment centers where you call, you know, two guys to come escort you in the middle of the night, and they wake you up, I don't know, put a bag over your head. I don't know what happened, but that's like what I imagine was going to happen. And she basically was like, great, well now, if you're going to go voluntarily, we'll just drive you on my And I walked out of the room and I didn't want to get sober anymore. It was gone, vanished into the wind, into the dust of the apartment. And now the plan was, well, if I have to go away, I'll just go away for like 6 months. I'll like dry out, I'll like physically like regain some health, I'll feel a little better. And my great obsession at this time, again, I'm only able to track it up to age 15, but at that time, my obsession was not that I was going to be able to manage and control my drinking like a lady or a gentleman. It was that I was going to be able to drink like an animal and nobody was going to be mad about it. You know? That I could be a full-time alcoholic drunk and like everybody would leave me alone. And it wouldn't cause any pain. You know? So that was the plan now. And I get driven up on a snowy January 10th morning. I think it was a Monday. My last drunk was particularly, oh, and the other thing was like, and if we're getting sober on Monday for a little while, we better have a really good time this weekend. And it sucked, you know, like I like wasn't having fun drinking anymore, but I was still trying, you know, even at that point. And it's like so awesome. Like I have so many friends here today. And when I think about like those last days for me, of just like being like hanging out with people I was hanging out with just for the opportunity to get drunk. It wasn't about them. I would just be sitting there wherever we were, looking around and like feeling like, I don't like any of you. Like I don't like this. I don't like you. I don't belong here. This doesn't feel good. But I gotta get drunk. Like that's what I needed to do. So the juxtaposition is that I have so many like rich friends. Rich friends. I may or may not have some rich friends, but like rich friendships is what I have. And most of them are here today, you know, and they're not necessarily here for me, but like if John James was speaking at this next year, I would be like, I'm going to come because I want to be here for you. I want to be with you. I want to do this. Like this is the fellowship. I had an experience a couple of years ago where I was working with a sponsor long distance and she was like, we were working steps, we were doing it over the phone. She was like really checking like my reliance on her. She was like, nah, you are going to call me when you have done the inventory and the prayer work that you need to do in order to bring something to the conversation. It's not going to be like, I call her and be like, here's everything. What do you think? It's going to be, I call her and say, here's everything. And here's what I was able to come up with through my discipline. What do you think about that? And then we got to be like partners. And then we got to like, then God was involved. And then we got to like really do it. And so that was an incredibly important experience for me to be sponsored by that woman. But she lives 5 hours away. And what I didn't do was I didn't really get connected with like a meeting that I was accountable to and with a group of people who knew me and with like a friendship group that I could run with and we could like get ice cream or do the things that we need to do together. Like I didn't have both and I needed both. And luckily through opening my heart to that and through feeling the fear of like, do I need a new sponsor? Like what's going on? Like what is this? And just really trusting that I was going to be moved into the right situation. I found an amazing sponsor here in the city. Who I love and who's part of the home group that I go to and who's part of my friendship circle and who's part of this like group that like makes me feel so excited to be sober and to be alive. I'm just going to check the time. Oh, good. Okay. When I... Hello?
waiting for something to fall down. When I talk about like being connected, or like going, like tapping back into that, like to the God within, or to that power that I need to stay sober, it's like really hard when I speak to like talk about all the incredible experiences actually working the steps. And honestly, like I've had so much fear about like doing this the wrong way, or like not doing it thorough enough, or like not really being connected to God, that like a lot of the really powerful, like the big book says fear should be classed with stealing because it seems to cause more problems. And like as a result of being so afraid, there's a lot of like really beautiful, awesome things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of showing up for suggestions that I don't remember. But I can't like remember like that amazing thing that God said when I made that amends, you know, because I was like terrified the whole time that I was doing the amends wrong, you know? And I couldn't just trust that like that it wasn't wrong. It was perfect. It was beautiful. I was showing up. You know, I was like stumbling, a friend of mine and I were on the phone this morning. We were talking about speaking, and I was doing a lot of inventory this morning on the fear of speaking and what I think I need from you in order to feel good, in order to feel safe, and like how that cuts me off from God. And she said, like, God doesn't care as much about what we say. God cares that we're like just stumbling on in the right direction, that we're just trying, you know. But when I talk about like tapping into that power, or getting like reconnected or reminded or revealed these things, really the way that I've been able to do that is through step work, you know. And that's really like what's cool is that like everybody who turns to step work and gets a sponsor and does that like has an experience that has the same instructions but is unique for you. But anyway, in my last 10 minutes, I end up at this school and my parents drove away. And then I was told that it's an 18-month minimum program that most people stay at for an average of 2.5 years. And they were gone. And I freaked out. I freaked out. You know, they took all my rap CDs. They took my belly button piercing out. I mean, I was the girl, like, I, like, could not show up for life. Like, I was really into the Jadakiss Champions League mixtape when I was, like, 14. And I would go to, I had to go to summer camp when I was 14. And I cut all the summer camp activities. And I just stayed in my cabin. And I put the Jadakiss Champions League mixtape on. And I couldn't show up for camp. I, like, had no interest in doing that. I just couldn't function. So they stripped everything from me. And this was a really interesting experience because I was, like, so insane, as I've just illustrated to all of you guys. So I really needed something super drastic in order to, like, stop me in my tracks and turn me around. But I also, like, was institutionalized for 2.5 years. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, like, and I'm 26 years old, and that was at, like, I was 15. I was, like, didn't know anything, you know? So for the last, like, 11 years, I've been trying to unpack these ideas of, like, authority and fear and that I'm going to get in trouble and all that stuff. So if there's anybody who's been institutionalized for any period of time and you left there sort of feeling like God was, like, watching you, like, you know, like you're an ant in the grass, like, I totally feel that. And it's been so important for me to do, like, second step work with sponsors where I'm examining, like, the ideas of God that aren't working for me, that are causing more fear in my life than they are causing, like, comfort and security, and that I don't have to stay aligned with that kind of God, you know? And that's not actually what AA is offering me. I end up at this school, and I really don't know what I was thinking for, like, a year that I was there. I had, like, a lot of different feelings. There was some times when I felt like I really wanted to change, and I felt really remorseful, and I had to, like, tell my parents a bunch of stuff that they should never have known about. But I wasn't really, like, conscious of the fact in my heart that, like, I needed help. Like, that I, like, needed to have an experience in order to have a different life. And I had a few cravings for drinking that came on me in that first year, and I was able to just kind of, like, feel them and enjoy them and, like, think about being drunk and, like, wishing I was out of this school. But then they would pass. And one day, it didn't pass. One day I was sitting there facing the corner, and it occurred to me that if I made a plan to run away, I could maybe hitchhike like 4 hours to the Bronx and see my best friend, who I missed desperately.
And a moment later, I didn't want to see my best friend anymore. It's like, well, if I'm going to, like, hitchhike and get 4 hours, like, and I'm going to be out of this property, then I might as well find somebody to, like, get me some alcohol, and then I'll be right again, you know? And so what happened to me at that point was that I passed my expiration date for how long I could go without a spiritual connection and stay sober. And it was so crazy, and I really didn't, like, want to do this. Sorry, my dad made lentils like an hour ago. Thank you for burping. I didn't, like, want to do this, but I had no power, you know? I couldn't, like, remind myself of how devastating it was going to be for my parents to get a phone call after, like, all that they had gone through to get me to this facility, and I had been there for a year, and they had, like, on some level, had peace of mind for almost a year. That, like, no matter what was going on to me, no matter what kind of crazy punishment I was in, it wasn't as bad as me being, like, missing at 3 o'clock in the morning and they didn't know where I was. And I could not think about that. Like, I couldn't remember how bad it was going to be for them to get that phone call that I was gone. I should probably wrap it up. Shut up. So I do this thing, you know, despite really not even wanting to. I make a plan, I figure out what needs to happen, and I try to run away. And I was not good at it. I got picked up, like, very close to the school, and I made a lot of stupid mistakes along the way. But I can't, like, the relief that came over me, knowing that I was going to get drunk that day, was, like, total freedom. It, like, set me free before even getting drunk. And basically what happened was I got back to the school, and the police found me, and I didn't get to relapse, and it was horrible. But I had this moment a few days later where out of nowhere, I, like, was outside of the school facility. I was on work sanction, which meant that I was not allowed to go to school, and I had to do, like, physical labor all morning and all afternoon. And out of nowhere, I, like, squatted down in front of the building, and I said the serenity prayer. Like, I don't know where that came from, but it just happened. And it was either later that day or a few days later. And I don't know if this happened at the same time, but at some point, I'm in the hallway and the bell rang. And I'm on, like, work detail, and everyone else is in school. And it's like it happened in slow motion. The bell rang, and all of a sudden, all these, like, kids, who I'm sure were, like, actually miserable, but in my mind, they, like, seemed really happy, came flooding out of the classrooms into the hallway, onto their next class. They had their computer bags. They were, like, dressed for class. I was wearing, like, sweatpants and my hair up. I wasn't allowed to, like, use any nice products. And they were, like, with their friends, and they were, like, living. And it was that, like, perfect moment again where, like, they were alive and they were connected. And I was not. I was, like, disconnected and alone. And I don't know. I just got to, like, such a deep spiritual and psychological misery. And it became clear to me that, like, all of my own ideas for how I was going to feel that connection again and feel safe in the world again, which, you know, at some point later down the line could have also been how I'm going to, like, stop drinking, I knew that it wasn't going to work. And in Bill's story, it says, for that moment, I needed and wanted God, and God was there. And it was, like, a real honest thing. And I just really wanted to feel free again. And that was, like, the start of it all. You know, that was the thing that made me go to my sponsor and say, okay, what do I do? And then she says, here's what you should do. And then I actually did it. And I feel like I'm out of things to say right now, but what's transpired between then and now is, like, a lot of one day at a time learning the lesson that I'm being given in AA and being willing to engage with that and being willing to use the steps. It took me, like, 7 or 8 years to complete my 8-step list. And a really cool story, there was this one amends that was like, you know, you get, like, thinky about them, and you're like, well, is it technically a harm, or is it just, like, something I shouldn't have done, or, like, you know, it's like, what's it going to be like to go find that person? And there was, like, a lot of noise and, like, emotional gymnastics around whether or not, for, like, years, for, like, 3 or 4 years. And I'm speaking at this meeting, and Richie H. is driving me home. And he's, like, such an men's guy, you know? So I'm, like, talking to him about it. And he basically just was like, yeah, sounds like you were an asshole. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's cleared up. So what do I do? And he says, I was in contact with this person's son. He said, go home, get, you know, sit at a desk and write a heartfelt letter. And it was like the most simple thing, but for some reason it took me that long to hear that, you know, which is like, which I'm okay with today, you know, because like at the very moment that I needed to hear that and I needed to show up for that amends, like I was given the power to do that. And I sat down, I wrote a heartfelt letter. And another beautiful thing that I picked up along the way from listening to a Big Book workshop is that like the amends is for the healing. And this is the current understanding that I work with step 9. The amends is for your healing. It's not for my healing. It's not about like whether I'm doing it right or not. This is, and it's not even necessarily about me coming to you and saying like, here's all the things that I did that hurt you. If you need me to say that to you and take responsibility for that stuff, then I'm able to show up and I have the awareness and I've done the foundation work for the amend and I can see my part. But like the best thing is that I get to say like, if it's not like a very specific isolated instance, that I get to say like, I didn't show up for you as the daughter that you deserve to have. And is there anything that I did that caused you harm that you need to tell me about? Because I'm showing up to take responsibility for that and for that healing. And I've made amends to people, and I felt super shameful about the stuff that I did, and the process of making that amend did not heal my shame. Like, I have to go to God for that. I didn't stop being embarrassed. I didn't stop beating myself up, but I showed up to try to make things right with the other person. And at that point, I have to trust that the truth about me is intact, you know, and that God's not judging me for these things. And that's the healing and the forgiveness work that I need to do for myself. But anyway, to wrap up this particular amends story, I was able to send a letter to this man. Basically what happened was he didn't like me and I was dating his son and he made it known and I came to his house drunk one night and I just acted a fool in his house. And I didn't say, you know, and he sort of called me out. He's like, well, it's nice when you go to someone's house to say thank you, you know, or to say hi or whatever. I like basically knocked on the door. He opened the door and the next thing I know, I was like sitting down. I was like so drunk and just being crazy. And I had been carrying this like feeling. So I write this letter, I send it out, and I get a voicemail a couple days later. Sarah, this is Mr. So-and-so. I got your letter. Whatever, we like played phone tag, but he sent me an email, and this man has been in AA for like 14 years.
Wow.
And he was like, and he's like, I've written so many of these letters myself, and I wish that this thing that you speak of was the worst thing on my conscience. But it's not, you know, and like this is, he basically just said, this is so beautiful, and call me anytime, and what did he say? Oh, that was amazing. Well, I don't remember, but it was like, I spent so much time in fear, and he was in AA. Oh, he said, I don't even remember the instance of which you speak. The moment it happened, I forgave you. You know, and it was just like so beautiful. Anyway, I think I'm out of time. The last thing, I have 1 minute literally. The last thing that I want to say about the amends is that somewhere in my fifth step experience when I was about 5 years, my sponsor offered to me this idea that like, basically he took my worth off the table. Most of the emotional disturbances that I have on a daily basis are like me, it's like about my worth as a person and me feeling like I'm not good enough or I need to be better than I am. It's like me trying to create myself in some way. And he basically was like, Sarah, the truth about you is like, it's happening through you. Like your heart is beating. You know what I mean? Like that's God. Like that's, you don't have to like, you're not responsible or in charge of your own goodness. You just have to remember that it exists and tap into it and enjoy it and use it in the world in a way that's like joyful and of service. And that made it really safe for me to like go make amends. Because if I'm like, if my mistakes are indicative of like my value as a person or my self-esteem, then I cannot look at myself objectively. I can't say I was wrong because I'm going to be like defending myself. But when I see that like the things that I do and the mistakes that I make have nothing to do with like my worth and value as a person, like that's coming from God, like I'm not in charge of that, it becomes really safe for me to be like, that sucked. What I did to you sucked, and I would never want to do that to you again. And how can I make it right? So with that, Sadly Sala.